God, thank you. Thank you for your presence here this morning. Thank you that you are with us, that you are for us, that you are very much fighting on our behalf, God, and that you have made a way. And God, we just welcome you. We welcome you to speak to us now this morning. God, I just give you this word. I give you this time and just ask that you would just lead it. Would you guide it? Would you speak through me this morning? Would you settle me and bring peace, God, where it's been a bad night and I'm a bit scattered. Father, I just pray that you would bring this all together. And yeah, just thank you for being here, God. So, oh dear, it was one of those nights. Does this sound all right? This sounds really echoey and weird to me. Is it? All right. So last week, for those of you who are here, Ben and I got prayed into the leadership. And one of the words that was spoken when my mum came up to pray, she gave us a word from Nehemiah 4. And she said at the time it wasn't just a word for us. She really felt it was something for the church. And as I went away and prayed about what God wanted me to speak on this week, this was what came up. It was Nehemiah 4. And so I thought, okay, we'll do a bit of digging into this and see what's in this word. And so I have to say it's already turned into two words. So you're going to have part one, which is amazing because I always write my, I'm like one of those kids who does their homework at the very last minute. And so it's always the same when I preach. I'm always, writing everything down the day before. So at least now I've got two. I've got the next one ready. It's amazing. It's fantastic. I've done like two in one. I think it could probably go into three, but we'll see how it goes. But anyways, we're going to start with a little history lesson. So instead of me trying to cram everything into this, this is going to be more of a foundation, I guess. So a bit of a history of Nehemiah, or Nehemiah, as I like to say. But Will won't tell, because I just keep spitting on them. So, when God took the Israelites out of Egypt, and he gave them his laws, he taught them his ways, he entered into covenant with them, he gave very clear, in those instructions, there was a very clear invitation and warning that if you follow my ways, it will lead to life and blessing. But if you disobey and you break these words of the covenant, it will lead to all of these consequences, these escalating consequences, these disciplines that would help lead them back into his love and into his ways. And so we all know what happened over and over again. Israel would chase after other gods. They would forget his ways. They would go completely off track. And the final consequence in the list of things would be that they would be taken into captivity and removed from their land. And so that is what happened. But every time he promised, even though he said, this is what will happen, this is like the ultimate consequence, you'll be taken into captivity, but I promise I will always bring you back. I'll always bring you back if you turn your hearts to me again. And so in 2 Kings 24, we read of the story of the kingdom of Babylon coming in and taking God's people into captivity. The walls are broken, the temple is burned, it's demolished, everything is in pieces, and God's people are taken away. But he prophesies, somebody prophesies, that it will be 70 years until they return. And so we're now down the track, about 50 years later, the kingdom of Babylon falls. The kingdom of Medes and Persia now are on the rise, and they're the dominant kingdom. They've taken over. And so God's people are now under their leadership, under their kingship. And so at 70 years, just as God promised, the Emperor Cyrus makes a decree. He's the Emperor of Persia. And he speaks and he says that the Jews, the exiles, are free to return. And so the first wave of Jews makes their way back, journeys across, and finds their way back to Jerusalem to begin to start rebuilding, to make it their home again. And so when they first get there, they're all, all gung-ho. First 10 years, they get the temple built, they rededicate it, but then everything comes to a standstill. Nothing else really happens. We know that in the book of Ezra is where we learn about that first wave going back. And then, I don't know, it's about 70, how many years later the next lot go? Much later, a second wave of exiles go. And then we get the book of Nehemiah. And this is a first-hand account of Nehemiah, who hears a report coming from that second wave. So the second lot of exiles have gone back, and so they're getting a fresh report of what's going on. What's happened? Is it built? Is everyone good? But he gets this report, and it basically says that the gates are still burned, the walls are still broken, the people are in trouble and in disgrace. And they've been there for 80 years at this point. All they've managed to do is that first 10 years, and then they've just kind of sat around and struggled and just not got on with things. So Nehemiah is the cupbearer to the king. He's a man of position in the Persian courts. But what he does is he goes to God. And because he's so grieved by that report, it really grieves his heart. He longs to see his people return. He very much has a heart for God. And, it wasn't like none of the Jews followed God. There was the national sin that drove them out. But many, there were those who still very much had a heart after God and were still seeking him and living in his ways. And Nehemiah was one of those. And so he begins to pray, and he prays and he intercedes for 4 months before he goes before the king. And the king sees that he's sad. And he says, what's wrong? That can only be a sadness of heart that I'm seeing on you. You've never been sad in my presence before. And so Nehemiah tells him, it's because my people are in disgrace, and how can I be happy when I know this is going on, this place of my ancestors? And so the king said, well, what do you want to do? He said, well, I'd like to go. Can I go? And then he even asks for provision. And so the king blesses him, and he sends him out. He sends him back to Jerusalem. He gives him an army to protect him. He gives him provision to go rebuild the gates. And so he goes out there filled with God's blessing, with God's vision, and he's a man on a mission. So he heads back to Jerusalem, and he takes with him a bunch of other Jews. But when he gets there, obviously, he already knew what he was going to find. But he sees the opposition. It's a city surrounded by enemies, basically. And so he sneaks out at night. He knows there'll be opposition to his plan. And so he sneaks out at night, and he goes and does a little tour around the walls, figure out where things are at, what do we need to do. And then he comes to the people. Then he gives them, this rallying call to come, let's do this, we can do this, let's rebuild the walls together. And so as soon as that happens, all the people say yes, because it is in their hearts, but they just didn't have the courage, they lacked the courage. And so finally they've got a bold leader who brings that vision and prayer and God's renewed call to build. So what does this mean for us? This was the word, that was kind of the history of Nehemiah, but it was Nehemiah 4 that particularly that was shared last week. So I'm just going to share a few little bits of that. We won't read the whole thing. So in verse 4, it starts to say, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, he said, what are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore the wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are? So initially, they just get ridiculed. It's just the enemy seeks to bring discouragement. Let's just knock them back off the perch. Let's just remind them that they're weak. But then, of course, the people do start building, They start to do things. And so next in verse 7, it says, when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, the Aramite, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to the wall had gone ahead and that the gaps were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God, and we posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. So the enemy now begins to attack. He sees, initially, They were just a weak people. They weren't really doing anything. All they needed was a bit of discouragement. We'll just knock them down a bit, knock them down a bit. But now, oh no, they're getting a bit full of themselves. They've actually started to build. They've actually started to do something. Things are coming together. Now we really are going to go against them. Now we're going to attack them. Now we're going to show them that they can't do this. But people begin not just to work, they also begin to pray. They begin to pray and they set a watch. You know, they're watching for what the enemy's doing. They're not going to be blind to the plan. They're on alert. The next bit in verse 13, it says, "Therefore I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, 'Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes.' From that day on, half my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor." So the people were watching over each other. They came together. They acted as a family. And they were equipped to fight. They didn't just have their work gear out. They had their weapons too. It was this dual thing of being able to carry on the work, but being prepared to fight and to care for each other. So then it carries on that those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other, that each of the builders wore a sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. And I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, "The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. So whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." So even though they've got their own bits to focus on, they've each got their own project, they've each got their own part, yet they're united. They stand and they, as soon as they hear a call to fight, they come to each other. You know, they're quick to rally together. They're not fighting alone. Nobody's left to deal with their own little bit on their own. So how does this relate to us? Because this is for us today. So God is rebuilding and restoring his church here in Berwick. Even as we meet in this building, you know, it's a place that has been used for years as a place of prayer and worship and then left empty for other purposes. And yet, God has called us and taken us here, and we get to rebuild. We get to dig that ancient well. We get to see God's presence back in this place. And that's not just about this building, but that's about Berwick, you know, and this whole area. You know, I don't know the details of the Christian heritage of this place, but we know that with Lindisfarne on our doorstep, the very birthplace of Christianity in this nation, we know that this place is so rich in that, you know, the word going out of God's presence in this place, of his word, of worship, all of these things. And those are deep wells waiting to be redug. But we also know that in more recent history, many have tried to come here. There have been lots of Christians who have come, churches who have tried, missions who have done things in the area, and most things have been shut down. Most things have failed. People have been taken out through one thing or another because it is a hard place. This town is a place of division that still lives on. Three communities. We've got Spittal, Tweedmouth, Berwick. Two nations, England and Scotland, that have fought and warred over this land over and over. And that's generations of that fighting, the hostility, the lack of trust, the, you know, this is mine, that is yours, and we're living in that atmosphere. You know, we're contending against that atmosphere. Because us, his remnant here, are called to build his church in Berwick. And we get to choose if we're going to live like those Jews did when they first went. They had that little bit of go for the first 10 years. They got the temple going. But then they let the discouragement, you know, they were living with, you know, they could see. Remember, those walls are broken all around them. They could see the enemy on every side. You know, it lists all those guys, Sanballat, Tobias, the Ammonites, people of Ashdod. You know, these were all hostile people, hostile nations that did not want this people to become great again, that did not want to see a city that was secure, safe, a people who once again became a threat. They wanted to keep them weak. They wanted to keep them subdued. It's all right, you can live there. Just pipe down, though. You can just stay there if you're not causing trouble. And so that's how they lived. They lived with this false peace, this false security, because they thought they were staying safe. So we get to choose. Are we going to live with that false peace of passivity and just fall into that trap of compromise? Or will we catch the vision like the people did when Nehemiah came back? Will we catch the vision of what God really wants to do, of the big plan? Because to them it seemed insurmountable. They'd been there for years and years and years and hadn't started to do this. They hadn't come together and united to do this. Will we pick up our swords? Will we build together? So Jonathan has been speaking these last few weeks on being new wineskins, on remaining flexible and able to move into the new things that God has for us. We talked about needing to build muscle. You know, we talked about Mr. Motivator. You know, you can't just jump straight from being a couch potato to running a marathon. There's a process. There's a building up. There's a training. And so I feel like this is what God is saying to us today. It's time to be trained. It's time to step into the training room, because we're going to be trained for war. In Psalm 144, it says, "Praise be to the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war, my fingers for battle. He is my loving God and my fortress, my stronghold and my deliverer, my shield in whom I take refuge and subdues peoples under me." And Psalm 149:6 also says, "May the praise of God be in their mouths and a double-edged sword in their hands." Okay, so we can sit and play church on a Sunday. We can have this outwardly Christian life, or we can have a living, dynamic spiritual life. So what does the rest of your week look like? Do you talk to God? Do you read his word? Are you facing up to areas of sin and dealing with them? Are you seeking help when you're struggling? Are you acknowledging those struggles and fears and disappointments? Are you walking in forgiveness? Are you seeking God's plans and purposes for you and for your loved ones and for this community? Because the source of our spiritual life is our daily communion with God. It's that closeness that we have that will give us strength. The closer we are to God, the stronger we will be. And so part of that training is learning to develop those daily habits more. It's finding our muscles in growing that time with him, that intimacy, that connectedness, that tuning into him on a daily basis. Because it's not just enough to sit in church and be familiar with the promises of God in his word. They're all for you. But if you just know them and don't really do anything about them, then, you know, you're kind of just, I don't know, hoping for things to land on you. Whereas, you know, God tells us that we need to lay hold of them. We're supposed to possess them. They're not gained passively. You know, there's a partnership. You know, we're not just puppets. We're not just here and God, you know, does what he wants. It's God is wanting to do so much, but he asks us to enter into it. He asks us to partner with him. He asks us to come and take hold of those things, to fight for things. We are called to be overcomers. So Romans 8:35-37 says, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger of sword? As it's written, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. There is nothing new under the sun." The enemy has no new tactics. He usually comes in first with some deceit, then some good old discouragement, some disillusionment, and division. Okay, because it's work. It works. It's worked every time. It worked for those Jews sitting in there. All they needed was to get their eyes off God, get their eyes off the one whose strength they needed to do it in, and just start thinking about themselves, start thinking about how weak they were. Now I've totally lost. Yeah. So anyways, all he knows, the enemy knows more than we do what we're actually capable of. And that, but all too often, we excuse ourselves as being too weak. And we think that we can't do it. Yeah, actually, we have all we need to succeed. And Paul says in 2 Corinthians 12, he says, my grace is sufficient for you, and my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, I am strong. It sounds easy, though, doesn't it? You know? But it's not. Jonathan used the life of David a couple of weeks ago in looking at those who have grown in their strength, who grew in their strength and their experience with God, and to become the giant slayer that we know him as. He didn't start as a giant slayer. He started with the smaller things. He started building up those muscles. He learned to fight. And he learned, more importantly, who was fighting with him. He knew that it was never about how strong he was. He knew it was never about his own abilities. You know, when he faced Goliath, he wasn't saying anything about himself. It was that the living God, but I come in the name of the living God. And so David was a brilliant example of someone who was first a worshiper. Like that psalm said, the praise of God was on their lips, but the sword was in their hands. You know, we've got to be a worshiper first. It's about the pursuit of God first. And as we draw close to him, then that success will come from him. Because David never pursued his enemies without first pursuing God. So then when God led him into war, he always completely defeated his enemies. Because he didn't go in that place of his own strength. He went with his eyes fully focused on God. And Psalm 18, the whole psalm is great, but it's particularly, it is God who arms me with strength and keeps my way secure. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He causes me to stand on the heights. He trains my hands for battle. My arms can bend a bow of bronze. You make your saving help my shield, and your right hand sustains me. Your help has made me great. You provide a broad path for my feet so that my ankles do not give way. I pursue my enemies and overtook them. I did not turn back until they were destroyed. So, you know, all the time he relates it back to God, that God makes him able to bend that bow of bronze. He can't do it on his own. God gives him the strength. God trains him for battle. God provides the way. So it's all about that pursuit of having God first, of putting him first, of seeking him and getting closer to him. But David is also a great example of the opposite, of giving in to the weariness of the world, of giving in to passivity and to compromise. Because we read in 2 Samuel 11 that at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, but David remained at Jerusalem. This was a time when God was calling him into something. It was the time for kings to go to war. But what was he doing instead? He was lying in his bed. He was lying in his bed till evening. It's, you know, you can read it two ways, but it sounds like potentially he was just, you know, he was just down, just not, you know, he was fed up of everything, whatever. We don't know what was going on in him, but we know that he was in his bed and got up in the evening. And what happens? We all know what happens next. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walking on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful to behold. Next comes adultery. Then comes murder. And then years of pain due to the consequences of those actions. All because he didn't go to war. All because he left the battle to others. Because he didn't step into the call of God on his life. Because when we're spiritually passive, we become spiritually vulnerable. Get that? When you're spiritually passive, because there is no middle ground. You know, you've heard that so many times. We know we're always either moving forwards or generally we're moving backwards. So if we're just sitting around waiting for things to happen, kind of leaving it up to God, not digging in, not pressing in, not fighting for things, not being tuned in to what it is God has for you and what is it he's wanting you to do today. It's not about being someone else, about, you know, it's like God has an individual plan and call for you. What does that battle look like for you? What is the call on you today? What is the fight that he wants you to enter into today? It's not the same for all of us. Yes, we've got things that we battle together, those things we're going to rally together. But you've each got your bit of the wall where you're defending something, your family members, your husband, your wife, your friends, whatever it is. There are circumstances that you have a call to fight for. Because if we don't step into the fight God calls us to, if we stay quiet instead of speaking out, if we bury our talents instead of using them, if we put up with compromise in our lives, if we let fear or shame paralyze us, we might think that we're staying safe. But instead, you'll be an easy target for the enemy to pick you off, just like David was. So God is calling us to grow in our strength and in our experience of who he is, who he wants to be for you. He's calling us to pick up our swords. He's calling us to get trained for war. So we need to take stock today. We need to ask him to reveal the true state of our spiritual lives. Do we have a religious life or a spiritual life? Is it dead on the inside? Is there compromise? Are there any areas where we're being passive, where we need to let him in and shake us up a bit? In Ephesians 6, I kind of want to finish on this, really. In Ephesians 6, it won't be that good. Well, sorry. Still take me a couple of minutes. It's a long finish. No. On Ephesians 6, I was just thinking about, you know, because I guess the bigger part of this is to really begin to look at prayer. And in my follow-up, we'll look at how do we pick up that sword? Why do we pick up that sword? What does it look more in depth at prayer? But first of all, I just felt like it was, you know, he wants to remind us of that armor. It says in Ephesians 6 that finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the might, power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you might be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against rulers of this dark age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the day of evil, and having done all, to stand. So stand therefore, having your waist girded with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking up the shield of faith, with which you'll be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take the helmet of salvation, and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. So prayer is a massive part of this. Prayer is very much part of that weaponry, that sword that we need to take up and the fight that we need to enter into. But my mum called me as I was doing this, and just happened to, you know, explaining what I was talking about, and said, "Oh, I've just been doing a study on Ephesians 6," and she took a photo of her Bible and sent me just this picture of what she'd been looking at. So I won't go into all the different bits, but the thing that really stood out was where it says the sword of the Spirit, where it talks about taking the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. The word there, I'd always read it to mean the whole of Scripture. But actually, there's two words. One is logos, which means all of Scripture. But the other word in Greek is rhema. And a rhema word, it means an utterance. It's like, you know, we usually think of it as being that, you know, like when you're reading your Bible and you're praying and a verse just kind of jumps off the page and it's just absolutely spoken to you in that minute into your circumstances. Or maybe it's in the words of a song that you're singing. Maybe it's in a prayer as someone prays over you. Maybe whatever it is, someone prophesies over you. A word that is from the Bible, but is taken in that moment, illuminated for you and for your circumstances. And so the word here is actually rhema. And so the words that are most effective to fight with are those rhema words. So, you know, it's like taking up that sword because you're taking up that promise. So this is, you know, it's like what I said before, it's no use us just sitting in church being familiar with God's promises. There's a whole Bible full of God's promises, and they are all for you. You can pray any of those. But there are promises that God wants to give you and speak over your circumstances, speak over your family, over your friends, whatever it is, over this church, that are now words, that are promises that are specifically for you in this season. And these are the things that we need to lay hold of. We need to possess them, so that we can fight for the promises of God over our circumstances, over our husband or wife, our children, our family, our friends, our church and our community. So today I want to just encourage you. Let's do away with passivity in our lives. Let's do away with that place of thinking that we're safe and trying to stay safe by just not engaging or by not pressing in. Let's put on the armor of God that we've just talked about. Let's pick up those promises. It's okay to start small. It's okay. We're not, you know, God doesn't call you to instantly be praying for the governments of the nation. You know, it's okay to start with your family. It's okay to begin to exercise those muscles over those in your closest sphere before you begin on the bigger spheres that he's calling us to. Because he is. So for every person or circumstance, as you go away this week, I want you to ask God, ask him for those rhema words, ask him for a sword that you can wield over that circumstance, ask him for that promise or that rhema word over your family member, over your friend, over whoever it is. Don't believe that you are weak. Believe that he is strong, believe that he has a promise and a plan and that you're part of it, to fight for that over them. Do you know what? After 70 years of passivity, when those Jews were sitting in Jerusalem with the broken walls, do you know how long it took after they got called, after Nehemiah came with nothing but some vision and prayer? It took 52 days. They'd sat there for 70 years doing nothing. And in less than 2 months, job done. Hey, they thought they were too weak. They thought they couldn't do it. They thought the enemy was too strong. They'd sat there wallowing in their discouragement. They'd sat there with their heads down, navel gazing, thinking about, oh, that's dangerous. They're insulting us. They could come against us. There's more of them than us. All they needed to do was come together. All they needed to do was rally to that vision, to hear the call of God, to stand with one another, not alone, because that's the difference. We're not called to any of this alone. We are a family. It talks about in those gaps, we're families. Well, you are a family. We are a family. And we get to fight together. We're not meant to do it alone. So if you're feeling discouraged, if you're feeling weak, get someone to stand with you. Remember, they've got a sword in their hand and they're building with the other. We're called to do that together. So don't let the enemy pick you off. Let him tell you that you're too weak. Because we do have major gaps in the walls still. there are, you know, we are going to come up against that discouragement, that ridicule, that even direct attack as we get more, these walls building. But we're a family, and we can do this together. As long as we hold on to God's promises, as long as we take up our swords, so get it polished up, get those rusty edges off, find it if you don't even know where it is. ask him to show you your sword. It's quite fun. Then you can tell me what yours looks like. Anyway, I won't do that today. But it's time to take up our swords. It's time to build something together, and we will succeed.